In 1992, there was a lot of there was a lot of reflection on the meaning of the last 500 years. Christopher Columbus and his discovery of America was celebrated as a major issue in as a major event for all humanity in 1893. There was a special celebration, a World's Fair created called the World's Columbian Exposition in Chicago. And Chicago had competed with New York, but Chicago, which was a kind of small western town, not a town, but it was much less developed than New York, but they gave this prize to Chicago because they were celebrating this expansion of Western civilization, the movement of the Judeo-Christian, Greco-Roman tradition from the Middle East into Europe, into Paris, into London, across the Atlantic, the westward expansion of the United States becoming part of this. So the idea of having the celebration in Chicago was seen as celebrating this expansion of the West. And there were tremendous events and celebrations at the world at the World's Columbian Exposition, which was in commemoration of 1492. There was, you know, huge industrial conferences. There were shows. There were Buffalo Bill Wild West Show was there, the World Parliament of Religion, American Historical Society, Frederick Jackson Turner gave a paper that is the most read and talked about paper in the history of writing about U.S. history, the significance of the frontier. Dvorak wrote the New World Symphony. He could see at this World's Columbian Exposition all the music events, he could see that the American music was going to be African music. Gatling led a convention of intellectual property issues. At this time, the United States already had twice as many patents as the rest of the world put together. So many of the influences, the branding of products was just beginning. Things like Aunt Jemima pancakes, Plapp's Blue Ribbon beer, shredded wheat. These brands were introduced at the World's Columbian Exposition. They were just starting to get into electricity, and there was a competition between direct energy or alternating current, and alternating current won. So then we go to 1992, and suddenly there's this surge, largely indigenous peoples from the Americas saying, why should we celebrate what happened when Columbus came and everything that happened since? When Columbus came, he came on behalf of the crowns of Castile and Aragon, Roman Catholic power. The Crusades had given rise to the Inquisition. The Inquisition was looking for heretics, the Cathars. Galileo, in his position that the sun was the center of the solar system, that the world wasn't the center of everything, that violated the Roman Catholic orthodoxy. So the Inquisition was extremely powerful. That was the attitude that prevailed when this Roman Catholic power stumbled upon what Christopher Columbus thought was India. All of Asia used to be referred to as India, called the people Indians. There's a place called the West Indies as opposed to the East Indies. That initial confusion is registered to this day. But just in case, the Vatican got in there and granted the Western Hemisphere, donated was the word, North and Central and South America, what became, or they didn't know the full configuration of it, but it was the donation of the Western Hemisphere to the federal government of Spain. And Portugal came along and said, well, we should get something too. So they changed, and Brazil to this day speaks Portuguese. But if you can imagine donating a whole hemisphere without any reference to the indigenous people of that hemisphere. So, you know, so in 1992, these things, unlike 1892, began to be focused upon. And so here's a book that was part of that, if we can go to the document camera, Rethinking Columbus. A special issue of Rethinking Schools dedicated to the children of the Americas. Here's the general tone and tenor of it. I lost that page, but it's kind of very surprising. Yeah. Here's a document, Proclamation from 1755 from William Shirley, the Captain General and Governor-in-Chief in and over His Majesty's provinces of Massachusetts Bay in New England, with and Vice Admiral of the same, a Major General in His Majesty's Army. So this is Massachusetts, just as the Seven Years' War is beginning. There is no such thing as the United States. It's in 1755, and this is a bounty. For every male Indian prisoner above the age of 12 years that shall be taken or brought to Boston, 50 pounds. For every male scalp brought in as evidence of their being killed, 40 pounds. Isn't this kind of astonishing to see? For every female Indian prisoner taken and brought in as aforesaid, and for every male Indian prisoner under the age of 12 years taken and brought in as aforesaid, 24 pounds. For every scalp of such female Indian or male Indian under 12 years of age brought in as evidence of their being killed as aforesaid, 20 pounds. Anyway, that's the kind of information that some were bringing forward in 1992, a very different atmosphere, a very different attitude towards the past had developed, obviously, in the 100 years between 1892-93 and 1993. And certainly the tone of the quincentenary and the idea of it was a factor in my thinking of the name of this course, Globalization Since 1492. As I was thinking of that document, or I stumbled upon that document of William Shirley, I thought the connection is a bit obscure, but in terms of surprising documents of that type, here is Dearborn, Michigan, which is on the which is part of Detroit, essentially, 1920. This is the Ford International Weekly, the Dearborn Independent. And the Dearborn Independent was purchased by this man, Henry Ford. Henry Ford is the founder of the Ford Motor Company. Henry Ford is largely given credit for the concept of the assembly line, of taking the product, the process of manufacturing and breaking it up into small pieces and automating it so that the same machines and the same workers do the same process repetitively, and combining all of these processes in a way that you come up with a standardized product flowing off the assembly line, and it makes things much more efficient, and you could make cars much more cheaply. Henry Ford was hugely opposed to trade unions, to labor unions. And of course, in 1917, the Bolshevik Revolution freaked capitalist people out. The concept that this idea of organizing the workers and taking control of the means of production had actually converged in the takeover of the world's largest country, Russia, and resulted in the creation of the Soviet Union. This created major consternation and response from many of the most powerful and rich individuals in the United States. Then when the New Deal, the kind of social democratic left-leaning deal brought to the American people by Franklin Delano Roosevelt came into play after the Great Depression in 1933-1934, there was much consternation at that time as well, and there was quite a bit of tendency to say we should build up fascist power in Italy, fascist power in Germany. Germany, after all, is the real battleground with communism. We've got to back up the fascists in Europe. And so Henry Ford was one of the early supporters of Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler had a big portrait of Henry Ford in his office. It's pretty well surmised that Henry Ford gave money to Adolf Hitler in the early days. But what he really did, he bought a little newspaper called the Dearborn Independent, and he had his people publish article after article asserting that the Russian Revolution culminating in the takeover by Lenin and the Bolsheviks was a Jewish conspiracy, that it was Jews who were behind this. Karl Marx, although he was atheist, his parentage, his family were Jewish, Jewish rabbis for that matter. And some might say that there is in that heritage a great devotion to texts, to studying your texts, to debating your texts, to knowing your history. You never, you may be forced out of an area in a pogrom, but you grab your texts, you study your texts. Why is it that there are many great Jewish lawyers and much of the social science theory, the really cutting edge stuff, has that heritage? But in any case, Henry Ford and others saw this, oh no, this is the Jewish capitalists and the Jewish communists, they're in cahoots. It's all some kind of international conspiracy. And he went to work to analyze that. He published the Protocols of the Zion Elders. Have you ever heard of the Protocols of the Zion Elders? It's written as if it's written by a group of elderly Jewish leaders who are giving advice on how to take over the world. And this has been published again and again, and it fuels anti-Semitism. It's pretty well been established as a forgery. In any case, Henry Ford published this material in Dearborn, in Detroit, as he's opposing trade unions. As part of his opposition to trade unions, he ups the pay, ironically, to $5 a day. This was seen as in 1914, this was seen as a huge, became hugely popular. It was a huge public relations coup. The theory was that by paying your workers better, they'll be able to buy a car. They'll be able to buy a Ford car. How are you going to get people to buy a Ford car? You've got to have a certain... The United States, was successful in bringing enough of the working class into the middle class that they fended off trade unionism. But now that all the manufacturing jobs are being outsourced, all of this is up for question now. The middle class is diminishing. These articles published by Ford's paper, the Dearborn Independent, were translated into German and were distributed widely in Europe, especially throughout Germany. And wherever you could buy Ford Motor Products, this was available. So imagine that title, The International Jew, The World's Worst Problem, published by the most famous entrepreneur in the United States. And this definitely gave the party, the National Socialists, And Hitler was, you know, playing with words because, you know, he's against socialists, really, but he's co-opting the word, the National Socialists. And he builds his party based on blaming the Jews for the fate that Germany was in, blaming the fate of Germany in the Treaty of Versailles. In fact, Woodrow Wilson didn't adhere to his 14 points. In fact, World War I ended up with a kind of victor's arrangement, which punished Germany, which sought war reparations, and created lots of room in Germany for resentment. And Hitler played on that resentment, and he made scapegoats of the Jews. And we see where that that led. This image I found quite extraordinary. Can you imagine to set this up? There is, you know, this is making a powerful statement. There's a manufactured image. There is a powerful machine at work here, you know, creating these images. I find this docu-camera for me is a bit of a revelation. I find myself just looking for interesting images. Can you imagine to set this image up? This took place in Iraq. I mean, this is high. This is the science of public persuasion, of public relations, of creating images that convey messages. Here is a John Stewart becomes the voice of the opposition in the United States, a comedy show. This is Adbusters, the culture jamming publication. Here's Donald Rumsfeld at the Pentagon. And I found this text quite compelling. The stories get twisted. The lessons get lost in the fog of mental pollution produced by the multi-billion-dollar marketing industry and in the bias of mega corporate press. We can't be expected to filter the science from the science for hire, the news from the PR, the reality from the entertainment and the hype. So too often we simply surrender to the vastness of the problem. The consequences of this surrender are grave. We start making bad decisions about the food we eat, the products we buy, the politicians we support. Consider terrorism. What is the cost of our media silence and our collective ignorance on the backstory, the possible root causes of Islamic terrorism? Debating these would seem like a basic first step in working towards reconciliation. Yet 5 years on, facile rhetoric about evildoers and freedom haters is the best our leaders can muster. It all points to the broader concern that collectively we may be losing the ability to understand the world around us. Information flows, so mediated, filtered, and spun from the top down, are becoming detached from reality. The disconnect is so serious that it can make us question our own sanity. And in turn, we ply ourselves with Prozac, Zoloft, and Paxil. And this addresses the fact that the commercial media, the media that reach vast masses, that carry advertisements that are sponsored, there's a great convergence of ownership of these media. And these corporations, of course, are not neutral players. They have a lot to defend. Their owners have a lot to defend. So stories get spun. There is an agenda. The commercial media seemingly have an agenda. At Seattle, for instance, there was a sense the protestors aren't going to be able to get their story out. The commercial media is not going to allow their positions, the stories and issues they want to bring forward, to be told in their own terms. So the thinking was, well, we need to create our own media. And that's what started to happen at Seattle. One of the fantastic, amazing things to see at Quebec City was to go to where the alternative media were. And you have all these young folks with their laptops and creating media, getting the story out. So the internet has become the source of alternative media. And I see this initiative as part of an effort to create an alternative media and to deal with the fact that we don't seem to be able to get at the truth. Now, who has truth? Where does truth lie? This is difficult issues. But if the university is for anything, that's what it's for, to figure out what is the bullshit and what is the truth. And, you know, we live in a time, for instance, weapons of mass destruction. Well, we're going to war because Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. Well, it turns out that was largely manufactured. That was largely spin. Are there consequences for that? What about if there would be distortions on that? What about what lies behind that 9/11? I mean, if you really go into, well, what was really going on? And why did certain things not happen? Why didn't these jet fighters that are supposed to scramble when a plane is hijacked or goes off course, why didn't it happen? It was supposed to happen as a matter of course. What about the third building that fell? You know, what about, you know, there was a third building that fell. There was no plane went into it. It happened to be the building that had some command headquarters that Giuliani first went into. And what was going on there? The Pentagon, was it really a huge passenger jet airliner that smashed into that? Was the damage to the Pentagon consistent with that, or was it a smaller missile that went in? There has really been no credible investigation. The investigation of the 9/11 Commission, there was a deal with the White House, what they would or would not give. These are serious issues. In a university, we take this responsibility, we should, if we're doing our jobs, pretty seriously. What is true? How do we tell what is true? You know, the European Enlightenment, the 18th century, when there was this move to say, we've been dealing with superstition too long. We've got to trust our rational senses. We've got to give logic its place. And gradually, you know, the church had to back off, and there was this secularization of society that took place. Universities are a place where, you know, there's been a lot of religious influence, and yet this should be the sacred ground of the Enlightenment philosophy. Other peoples have their own approach to truth. You were going to make a point, yeah. What's your name? Yeah, I do, really do.
My point, or my question, I guess, would be that do you think that the internet and universities will eventually have people trying to control them? And if so, what kind of steps would you suggest in stopping that? Or should they be stopped?
Well, there's definitely a move bring corporations more into the management of universities. Universities are corporations. There are beginning to be profit-making corporations, like private corporations. Is the university the public space that belongs to society collectively? What should be the role of government? What should be the role of corporations? As governments, as this process of neoliberal globalization or capitalist globalization proceeded in the 90s, there was a view that business should run perhaps healthcare, business should run perhaps universities. Once you started to see Pizza Hut and Coke around the campus, and Pepsi and Coke, they bid, you know, if you have one, you can't have the other. I mean, this is part of a process. So who is going to control universities? What's the future of the concept of academic freedom? These are serious questions.